Well, good morning, good afternoon, or good evening to you from wherever you're listening, wherever in the world. My name is Martin Kiernan. My day job, I'm a nurse consultant in infection prevention in the UK. And it's my great pleasure to introduce tonight's speaker to you. It is, of course, Dr. William Jarvis, a man who needs no introduction. However, he will get a short one. If I was to detail all of his achievements, all of his time would be used up. But suffice to say that he is former director of the Office of Extramural Research at the CDC. He's edited Infection Control and Hospital Epidemiology. He's a former president of SHEA. He has at least 400 publications to his name and has been involved in guideline writing all over the world. So it's a great pleasure to introduce Dr. Jarvis to you, and we'll sit back and listen to his lecture, Healthcare Associated Infection Prevention Bundles, Preventing the Preventable. Welcome, Dr. Jarvis.
Thank you, Martin. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you, everyone, for joining. As Martin said, we're going to talk about healthcare-associated infection prevention bundles, preventing the preventable. To begin with, I consult for a number of companies, including CDC and APIC, but none of them have influenced this presentation. The purpose of today's presentation is first to discuss the expanding horizon of infection prevention and control, and hopefully convince you that we should be moving toward an attitude of zero tolerance. Second is to provide an overview of selected healthcare-associated infections, most of which are associated with medical devices. Third is to illustrate how these healthcare-associated infections, or HAIs, cause morbidity and mortality. And then last and most important, to illustrate how applying current infection prevention and control measures, together with the proper use of medical technology and bundles, can reduce these adverse events. Let's begin with the most common healthcare-associated infections, and that's UTIs, urinary tract infections. Most, approximately 80% of UTIs are associated with urinary catheterization, and approximately 25% of inpatients in the developed world are catheterized. A variety of estimates have been made, but in general, UTIs add about one extra day of hospital cost and a little bit less than $1,000 in cost. And some have estimated that about 7,500 people die each year in the United States alone from UTIs. One of the problems with UTIs, and it's certainly recognized and discussed in the CDC UTI guideline that came out in 2009, was having an appropriate indication for catheter insertion. Shown on this slide are the indications from the former guideline, but the 2009 guideline has basically the same indications. And when we look at the both initial and total patient days of patients being initially catheterized or the number of patient days of catheterization, we can see from this article from Jan and colleagues in the Archives of Internal Medicine that a substantial number of initial catheterizations and an even larger proportion of all catheter days are unjustified, and that they do not meet these indications. So why are catheters used inappropriately? At least one hypothesis has been perhaps physicians forget that their patient has a urinary tract catheter. And so a study was done by Sanjay Saint to determine the extent to which physicians are aware that their inpatients have urinary catheters. And they surveyed 56 medical teams at four different sites. 256 providers responded, so a very good response rate, about 89%. And what they found was that the lower your level of training, the more likely you were to actually contact a patient and know they had a catheter in place. For example, medical students were only unaware of their patient not having a catheter 18% of the time, interns 22% of the time, residents 28% of the time, and attending physicians nearly 40% of the time were unaware that their patient that they were responsible for had a urinary catheter in place. That's led to the suggestion that perhaps we need to use urinary catheter reminders. For instance, for surgical patients when they come out of surgery, or even medical patients, to remind clinicians periodically that their patient has a urinary catheter and require them to justify the continuance of that catheter. In another study done by Sanjay Saint, published in CID, Clinical Infectious Disease, in 2008, they did a national survey of UTI prevention practices This was done in the United States in non-federal hospitals with intensive care units with greater than 50 beds, about 600 hospitals, and the VA Veterans Administration System hospitals, about 119. They had, again, a very high response rate, about 72%. When they asked the question, do you monitor who is catheterized, only 44% of them acknowledged doing that. When they asked, do you monitor the duration of catheterization, even fewer, 36% did that. Using antimicrobial antiseptic impregnated catheters, even lower, 30%. Use of condom catheters, even lower, 14%. And use of this catheter reminder was less than 20%. So certainly there's room for improvement in both the monitoring, selection of patients, and use of appropriate technologies for prevention of UTIs. In another study by Sanjay Saint, he looked at what is the value of silver alloy catheters. He did a meta-analysis of all published studies and then published his study in American Journal of Medicine in 1998. There was 117 reports retrieved. He found 8 trials where silver alloy impregnated catheters were used. And the summary odds ratio, or OR, for UTI was 0.59%, so about a 40% reduction in catheter-associated UTIs when silver alloy impregnated catheters were used versus non-impregnated catheters. And he argued that silver alloy catheters are significantly more effective in preventing UTIs than silver oxide, and that even with their extra cost, they may be worth that extra cost in prevention. He then, in another study, looked at the potential clinical and economic benefits of these catheters. This was a decision model, so more of a mathematical model approach, performed from the healthcare payer's perspective. And he evaluated this cohort of about 1,000 hospitalized patients on general medical, surgical, urologic, or ICU wards who would have short-term catheterization from 2 to 10 days. And then he compared two approaches, either using silver alloy impregnated catheters or non-coated catheters. And as you can see, if you look at the outcome in terms of symptomatic UTI or SUTI, there was about a 47% reduction with silver alloy impregnated catheters. BSI is about a 44% reduction. And in terms of cost, there was a cost savings of $4 per patient. So we argued that using silver alloy catheters in hospital patients requiring short-term catheterization reduces symptomatic UTI, bacteremia, and saves money. So we look at silver catheters. What is the evidence based? Well, to date, there's been about 11 comparative studies of, or 2 meta-analyses of, silver alloy catheters, the majority of them being silver alloy, versus non-coated Foley catheters. In every comparative trial, the number of catheter-associated UTIs has been decreased in the impregnated silver-coated catheter group compared to the non-coated group. However, in some of these studies, the number of patients included has been small, and the statistical significant decreases in catheter-associated UTIs has not been detected, really more an epidemiologic issue of insufficient power. Nevertheless, in every one of those studies, when you look at the direction, there's been a decrease in the rate of catheter-associated UTI or catheter-associated bacteria in the silver alloy impregnated group. In both of the meta-analyses, combining a variety of studies to try to increase the power to detect a significant difference, the authors have concluded that silver alloy coated catheters associated with significant reduction in both asymptomatic and symptomatic UTI. I think the data are strong in supporting that silver alloy hydrogel impregnated catheters can decrease catheter-associated UTI or bacteria compared to non-coated catheters in patients who are catheterized for 3 to 7 days. In fact, if we look at a Cochrane analysis, and this is done by Brosnahan and colleagues, an independent analysis, looking at the data, they looked at two things. This slide shows asymptomatic bacteria, which used to be part of the CDC definition of UTI, but changed, and I believe, about January of 2008. But you can see here that there's a significant reduction in asymptomatic UTI when silver alloy impregnated catheters are used. The next page of this same study looks not at asymptomatic, but at symptomatic UTI. So this is the current CDC definition of catheter-associated UTI. And as you can see from the little kind of diamond at the bottom there, there is a significant reduction in catheter-associated UTI when silver alloy impregnated catheters are used compared to standard non-impregnated catheters. So in terms of a catheter UTI prevention bundle, we have certainly the most important, which is only use urethral catheters when they're necessary. They should not be used for nursing convenience. Catheters should be inserted or manipulated by those who are educated and competent. We should use aseptic technique for insertion and manipulation. We should always maintain a closed drainage system. We should require urinary catheter insertion indication or order and consider using an administrative stop order or at least a reminder to limit inappropriate catheterization. And then consider silver catheters in high-risk patients who are going to require catheterization for 2 to 10 days. If we do these things, there is evidence to suggest that the prevention possibility ranges from 20 to 70% of these infections. Next, let's talk about centerline-associated bloodstream infections. We look at the impact of primary bloodstream infections, and if you look at just every patient that's in your hospital that has a vascular catheter, about 10 to 40% of those patients will die. But obviously, many of those deaths are due to underlying disease, severity of illness, and really not related directly to the catheter. But if we control for that, there's about 2 to 15% of those patients who die directly as a result of the catheter-related bloodstream infection. The driver for cost everywhere in the world is prolongation of hospitalization, and these bloodstream infections result in at least 5 to 20 days of extra hospitalization to treat that infection. And this, not surprisingly, results in considerable attributable cost, ranging in published studies from $34,000 to almost $60,000 per episode. In October of 2008, the Society of Healthcare Epidemiology of America published their strategies to prevent centerline-associated bloodstream infections and infection control in hospital epidemiology. In this document, they talked about basic and special approaches, with their basic approach being use of a catheter checklist, performing hand hygiene before catheter insertion, selecting the right catheter and putting it in the right place, in particular avoiding femoral line, using a catheter cart or kit that has everything that the clinician needs for that insertion, using maximal bearer precautions, and chlorhexidine with alcohol skin prep. As I said, Shea called this basic practice, as I would call it, a catheter insertion bundle. And if your patients only have a catheter in place for 1, 2, or maybe 3 days, that may be all you need. But most of us have patients that have catheters in for much longer than that, in which case, what Shea called the special approaches, which I would call a maintenance bundle, becomes important. The first element is chlorhexidine bathing of intensive care unit patients. We look at the data on that. It had the biggest impact on vancomycin-resistant enterococci. Several studies have shown value reducing VRE colonization and VSI. This chlorhexidine bathing in the two studies done in surgical intensive care units have not shown a significant decrease in VSI. And the data are mixed in studies on overall VSI reduction or even MRSA VSI reduction. Then use of impregnated, either antiseptic or antimicrobial impregnated catheters, use of the chlorhexidine impregnated sponge or biopatch, and use of antimicrobial locks or flushes. As you know, the CDC HCPCS draft guideline came out in 2009 and finalized just last Friday. This guideline emphasizes a number of important areas in the beginning. The first is education and training of healthcare personnel who insert and maintain catheters, moving away from C1, D1, D20. Using maximal bearer precautions during catheter insertion, using a 0.5% or greater chlorhexidine-based prep for skin antisepsis, avoiding routine replacement of central venous catheters, using antibiotic or antiseptic impregnated short-term central venous catheters, use of this chlorhexidine-impregnated sponge dressing, and then emphasizing the importance of performance improvement or quality improvement initiatives implementing these bundled strategies. To see why the insertion and maintenance bundles are important, we need to understand the pathogenesis of how these infections occur. On this slide, you see extraluminal colonization and intraluminal colonization. When you're inserting that catheter, even if you've done the best skin antisepsis possible, at least 20% of the organism will remain in the skin, hair follicles, or sebaceous glands. And so when you insert that catheter, as shown here, you may pick up a few bacteria, and they stick to the outside of the catheter, produce an exopolysaccharide or biofilm, and the organisms can replicate and ultimately can cause an infection. This is extraluminal colonization due to extraluminal biofilm and is felt to be the major source of infection in the first week of catheterization. Then after that catheter is in place, we manipulate the three-way stopcock, the needleless connector, we give boluses of medication, we add IV medications, and we contaminate the internal surface of the catheter, and the same type of process occurs. Those bacteria showed as little red dots attached to the internal surface, or the intraluminal surface of the catheter. They produce a biofilm, reproduce, and then can cause infection. And studies have been done to show that these two mechanisms work in all patient groups, neonates, older pediatric patients, adult patients, regardless of where they are in the hospital. Extraluminal colonization first, intraluminal colonization second. So our prevention interventions have to be aimed at preventing both of these from occurring. Next, we need to understand where do the pathogens come from that cause these infections to occur. Well, in the developed world, contamination of infusates, either intrinsic or extrinsic contamination, is becoming a pretty rare event. Intrinsic contamination is about 1 in a million opportunity. And now as we move toward either pharmacy-prepared medications or unit-dose medications, even extrinsic contamination of medications is becoming less and less frequent because we no longer have nurses at the bedside manipulating the medications. So it's thought that at least in the United States and most of the developed world, this is less than 1% of infections. Second is contamination of the catheter hub, either needleless connector or stopcock. And the source can be either our hands or the patient's endogenous skin flora. And this is thought to account for at least 12, and I think probably a little bit higher than that, percent of our infections. And then last, and most important, are our organisms on our hand and the patient's own skin flora, accounting for approximately 60% of the infections. So if we look at an insertion bundle, it includes inserting a catheter only when clinically essential, using a checklist, having a cart or kit with everything the clinician needs so they don't have to think about it, they don't have to go get it, it's right there in front of them, performing hand hygiene before inserting the catheter, using alcohol, chlorhexidine-based skin antiseptic, using maximal bare precautions, and then selecting the right catheter and inserting it in the right place, particularly avoiding the femoral line. This is an example of the checklist from the Shea Compendium, listing on the left all the different activities, second column, the recommendation level, third column, a full description of it, and then last, whether it was done or not. The value of this checklist, I think, is threefold. First, it's telling your clinicians this is the minimum they must do every time. They can do more, but they cannot do less. Second is it's an opportunity for you to collect compliance data on the clinicians, and as shown on the next slide, concatenate that data and analyze it on a periodic basis to show the clinician how many lines they put in, did they use all barrier precautions, hand hygiene, did they use femoral lines, what did they use for skin prep, et cetera, et cetera. So hopefully if you have one or two individuals who are not complying, you embarrass them back into compliance. The third value of this checklist is that if you have a bloodstream infection, particularly if it leads to unexpected death, the Joint Commission has recommended that you do a root cause analysis. Well, most of us really don't have any idea how to do a root cause analysis, but one of the things that we would do would be to interview the clinician who inserted that catheter. Well, that may have been yesterday, but it might have been a week ago or 2 months ago. So more likely than not, the clinician will not remember what they did on that particular patient, and they will tell you what they think they should have done. In contrast, if you pull out this document, it was completed in an independent, unbiased fashion at the time of catheter insertion, you can tell whether everything was done correctly or not. If so, then perhaps this was not a preventable infection. On the other hand, if not, then it's an opportunity to document it, show it to the clinician, and educate them about what they should be doing. The next slide shows just an example of a catheter kit. This is becoming very, very common in North America, but is yet relatively uncommon throughout the rest of the world. Use of a kit such as this eliminates the need for the clinician to be knowledgeable and know what they need to do, or second, think about it and go get it. We don't have surgeons leaving the operating room to go get something that they forgot. Either it's there or somebody else goes and gets it. So we don't want the clinician, when they're inserting a catheter, to go wandering off across the room or down the hallway to go get something. If you have a catheter kit, and these can be made exactly as you want them, including whatever you want in it, it can be very useful to the clinician. Why do we recommend chlorhexidine for skin prep? Well, it's really based on a variety of randomized control trials that were done comparing chlorhexidine with alcohol to povidone iodine without alcohol. And this is a meta-analysis published in Annals of Internal Medicine in 2002, summarizing the studies up to that time. And as you can see, the black box is the median rate. The median rate in every case is either at 1, which is equivalence, or to the left of 1, which means that chlorhexidine is superior. And in fact, if you look at the bottom, a little triangle or a little diamond, that's a summary risk ratio of 0.49. So you have about a 50% reduction in catheter-related infections when you use chlorhexidine with alcohol versus povidone iodine without alcohol. Now realize there's a little bit of bias here in that you have two agents, chlorhexidine with alcohol on one side and povidone iodine without alcohol on the other. There's been at least two studies looking at surgical site infections where chlorhexidine with alcohol versus povidone iodine with alcohol have been studied that show equivalence. The one difference is that povidone iodine with alcohol needs to dry for at least 2 minutes because iodine, povidone iodine, works by releasing free iodine. So it needs a little bit longer to dry, whereas chlorhexidine should be applied vigorously for 30 seconds and then allowed to dry for 30 seconds. Next is maximum bearer precautions. And as you can see, the inserter is capped, gowned, masked, and gloved, has a Carter kit next to him with everything that he needs, and the patient is covered from head to foot. So we're treating the insertion of the catheter as if it's a surgical procedure. Not like when I trained, but we didn't do that. And if I dropped the syringe, I dropped the needle, I dropped the catheter, it would drop onto the patient's gown or the bedside. Now it falls into a sterile field. Next is the one randomized controlled trial evaluating use of maximum bearer precautions. On the right where it says no precautions, it's not that they did nothing, it's they did an insertion bundle without maximum bearer precautions, and then precautions is with maximum bearer precautions. This is done at MD Anderson Tumor Institute in a somewhat higher risk cancer population. If you look, white is total infections, and yellow is infections in the first 2 months, which is a very, very liberal definition of early infections. Regardless, you see that for both total infections and infections in the first 2 months, both significantly decreased when maximum bearer precautions were used. Now, this is the only randomized control trial of this. There have been a number of now before-after studies that have documented a decrease as well. But as I mentioned, if the patient has a catheter for a longer period of time, you really need to think about a maintenance bundle. That includes minimizing catheter site bioburden, device selection, both catheter and needle's connector, aseptic manipulation of the catheter connector or scrub the hub, use of antibiotic or antiseptic locks, and use of antimicrobial or antiseptic impregnated catheters. I think our clinicians often forget the biology of the skin. and that 80% of the resident bacteria in the first five layers. 20% of those organisms are in biofilms or hair follicles or sebaceous glands and remain regardless of how long you do skin anasepsis. And once you stop that skin anasepsis, those organisms begin to grow again. And by 18 to 24 hours, they're back to the levels that they were to begin with. Furthermore, if we look at different parts of our body, the bioburden varies. This is a patient who has a catheter placed in the antecubital fossa, and where that black square is, taken a swab and swabbed it onto a blood auger plate. And all of us can see pinpoint colonies. There's about 10 to 20 coliform units per cubic centimeter. We do exactly the same thing, but now do it in a catheter that's been inserted in the subclavicular area. It's very difficult to find any pinpoint colonies. It's almost too numerous to count. And there's 10 to the 3 to 10 to the 4 colony-forming units per ml. If we would do the same thing in the femoral area, we'd be talking about 10 to the 6 to 10 to the 8 colony-forming units per ml. So if you remember, we're going to, under the best of circumstances, have 20% of the organisms left after our skin anasepsis. We're talking about 20% of 10 versus 20% of 10 to the 3, 10 to the 4 versus 20% of 10 to the 6, 10 to the 8. And that at least partially explains why femoral lines have the highest rate of infection. Internal jugulars are second, subclavians are third, and cubitals, brachials are fourth. Two studies have come out since the Shea compendium and before the CDC guidelines was published, looking at the impact of use of this chlorhexidine impregnated sponge. The first is by Timpson and colleagues, published in JAMA in March of 2008, where they did a randomized controlled trial in medical, surgical, and medical surgical units at seven different hospitals in Paris. And they looked at two things. One was, if they're using an insertion bundle, and they used slightly different skin anasepsis, but otherwise it was exactly the same as what I'd mentioned, and they added to that the biopatch, or this chlorhexidine impregnated sponge, did it make any difference? Secondly, if they changed the dressing at 3 days versus 7 days, did it make any difference? I don't have time to go into the latter, but the bottom line was it didn't make any difference. If you change the dressing at 3 days versus 7 days, the infection rate was similar. So we can change the dressing at 7 days, save nursing time, save equipment expense, and not have any detrimental effect on our patients. This is a table from the Timpson study, and if you look at the first column, but the second row, third row, where it says catheter-related bloodstream infections, we're going to focus in that area. The first thing you see is that in the control group, the transparent dressing group, the median VSI rate was 1.3 per 1,000 catheter days. This study was done about 5 years ago. That was much lower than the NHSN, the CDC's National Healthcare Safety Network median rate for these types of ICUs was at that time, so a very low rate of infection. Part of that may be explained by the fact that the French don't use many femoral lines, if any. And at least at this time, they didn't use any PICCs either. So to have a low rate like this and have an intervention that can reach statistical significance is really pretty powerful. And yet, as you see in the next column, the BSI rate in the chlorhexidine impregnated sponge or biopatch group was 0.4 per 1,000 catheter days. Literally a 76% reduction in bloodstream infection rate when they added this biopatch to their insertion bundle. And as you can see, p-value is 0.005. Another issue comes up is what about the use of impregnated catheters? There's a very nice meta-analysis recently done by Casey and colleagues, published in Lancet in 2008. And I have two figures from that publication. The first looks at colonization, and it provides data on a wide variety of different types of impregnated catheters. But to focus your attention on first-generation silver sulfidiazine, second-generation silver sulfidiazine, and a minocycline rifampin impregnated catheters, because those are the major players in the world. And what you see there is all of them significantly reduce catheter colonization. The next slide shows catheter-related bloodstream infections. And what you see there is that, number one, the number of studies is more limited. And second is that the second generation sober subsidizing slightly overlap one, that black line going up and down. Doesn't quite reach statistical significance, whereas the minocycline rifampin catheter does. I think at least one partial explanation for that is that the minocycline rifampin catheter has been primarily studied in cancer patients who have a higher rate of bloodstream infection to begin with, so it's a little bit easier to show a significant difference, whereas the sober subsidizing catheters have been studied in ICU patients where the rates have been a little bit lower. But I think the data show that both of them will reduce colonization and bloodstream infections. What about needleless connectors? There's been a number of studies that have suggested that if you move from split septum to mechanical valve, it increases the risk of infection. Salgado and colleagues used the split septum interlink. Their BSI rate was about 1.8. They moved to a negative pressure mechanical valve, and their BSI rate more than doubled to 5.4. Dr. Rupp from the University of Nebraska published his study where they were, again, using interlink split septum. Their BSI rate was about 3.9. They moved to a positive pressure, positive displacement needleless connector, and their BSI rate nearly tripled to 10.43. And then Fields and colleagues out of Australia were using interlink BSI rate of 2.6. They changed to both a negative clave and positive pressure CLC 2000 needleless connectors, and their BSI rate doubled to 5.8. We published a study that involved a number of hospitals, multi-center, international, where they were using either interlink primarily or one was using needles, and the BSI rate was 6.15, and they changed to a variety of positive or negative pressure connectors, and the BSI rate increased to 9.49. And then last, Toscano and colleagues, where they were using needles in a stem cell transplant population, BSI rate 0.7, they moved to a positive, or excuse me, a negative pressure connector, and their BSI rate tripled to 2.1. And many of these hospitals represented in these outbreaks, they tried to do education, and could not get the rate to go down, and ultimately had to change back to split septum technology, and the BSI rate returned to baseline or even below baseline levels. Both Shea in the compendium and CDC in their guidelines have made recommendations regarding these connectors. Shea's recommendation is do not routinely use positive pressure needleless connectors with mechanical valves before a thorough assessment of risk, benefits, and education regarding proper use. The CDC in their guideline that came out last Friday goes even further. They say when needleless systems are used, a split septum valve may be preferred over a mechanical valve due to increased risk of infection with some mechanical valves. What about interventions that show that if we do the thing that I talked about, it will reduce patient infections and save money? Probably the most famous is a study by Kronovost and colleagues published in New England Journal, where a large number of hospitals in Michigan participated with their ICUs in an intervention. They had 103 ICUs, almost 2,000 months of ICU data, almost 400,000 catheter days. The median rate of BSI in these hospitals at baseline was 2.7 per 1,000 catheter days, so still a pretty low infection rate. But by 3 months, by the implementation of an insertion bundle, their BSI rate was zero, median rate was zero. That's not one ICU, that's more than 66 ICUs that have zero BSI rate. As I mentioned, they focused primarily on insertion bundles. But there were elements of the maintenance bundles used by the hospitals, but the data were not collected. So some used the biopatch, some used impregnated catheters, some used chlorhexidine bathing with patients, but we don't know who did what. I suspect that may be part of the reason the not complete and full application of both a maintenance and an insertion bundle that may have led to the fact that at 16 to 18 months, the BSI rate reverted slightly to 1.4 per 1,000 catheter days. That's still a 66% reduction in catheter-related bloodstream infections in these 103 ICUs. Recently, a couple of weeks ago, the CDC published data in the MMWR comparing the BSI rate at participating hospitals in 2001 to 2008 and 9. A number of issues related to this. First of all, in 2001, there were about 370 hospitals who were voluntarily in the system and wanted to apply the definitions correctly and were unbiased and hopefully in their reporting, whereas in 2008 and 2009, there's somewhere between 3,000 and 4,000 hospitals reporting, most of whom haven't been trained that well, who are doing it primarily because of mandatory reporting in their state. But nevertheless, when CDC compared the BSI rate in the ICU in 2001 to 2009, given a variety of other adjustments that were made, including adjusting for a change in the BSI definition, the BSI in 2001 was 43,000 versus 18,000 in 2009. Note that both the inpatient wards and in particular outpatient hemodialysis are even higher, showing we have a lot of work to do outside of ICUs as well. CDC estimated that in 2009 there were 25,000 fewer central line-associated bloodstream infections, and that there had been a 58% reduction between 2001 and 2009, some 6,000 lives saved, $414 million in potential excess healthcare costs saved just in 2009, and an estimated $1.8 billion cumulative excess healthcare costs since 2001. So we know what to do. To prevent these infections from occurring, we need an insertion bundle, including a catheter checklist, hand hygiene, picking the right catheter, putting in the right place, avoiding femoral lines, a cart or kit, maximum bear precautions, and chlorhexidine skin prep, and for maintenance bundle, selecting the safest needleless connector, scrubbing the hub, antiseptic or antimicrobial impregnated catheters, chlorhexidine impregnated sponge or bio patch, and antimicrobial or antiseptic locks. Data from a variety of studies, not just the Keystone Project, but studies done in Johns Hopkins in their surgical ICU, as well as Arkansas Children's Hospital, Children's Hospital Corporation of America, and National Association of Children and Related Institutions, showing that in both pediatric and adult patients, we can have a prevention possibility of anywhere from 70 to 100% using such bundles. We need to keep in mind that the majority of our catheter-related bloodstream infections actually occur outside of the ICU. So we focused all of this attention on the ICU, which has had a dramatic and very important impact on patient safety, but we really should be mandating use of an insertion and maintenance bundle in all ICUs today, and instead be funding studies to expand these interventions outside of ICUs where approximately 70% of BSIs occur. And where I think IV teams are going to be necessary. Next, let's talk about ventilator-associated pneumonia. Ventilator-associated pneumonia, or VAP, is the most common healthcare-associated infection in critical care ICU patients. A variety of risk factors, including age, chronic obstructive lung disease, trauma, gastric aspiration, the duration of ventilation, elevated gastric pH, etc. About 10 to 20% of patients ventilated for more than 48 hours will develop VAP. VAP has a tremendous impact. Attributable extra ICU stay of 22 days. ICU patients who develop VAP are twice as likely to die. Crude mortality rates are 60%. Attributable mortality rates are 27 to 43%. And the attributable cost, almost $16,000 per episode. We've come up with a ventilator management bundle, including chlorhexidine on the unit for both hand hygiene in particular, but also possibly for oral care, using something else for oral care, sedation reduction or sedation vacation, using deep vein thrombosis, and peptic ulcer disease prophylaxis, using ventilator weaning protocol, continuous aspiration of subglottic secretions, and elevation of the head of the bed. Now, it should be pointed out that this VAP bundle was really not developed to prevent VAP. It really was aimed more at deep vein thromboses and peptic ulcer disease, but was found to have an impact on VAP. Similar to the checklist for compliance monitoring with underlying-associated bloodstream infections, we need to have the ventilator-associated pneumonia bundle compliance tool as well. One is shown here, where you'd have the patient and then the various elements in the bundle. So you can see compliance rates. One of the biggest changes in our approach to patients in the ICU has been the recognition that their oral flora may be of some benefit or importance in terms of ventilator-associated pneumonia. In a number of studies looking at oral decontamination with chlorhexidine. The first by Coleman and colleagues, published in 2006, was a randomized double-blind placebo-controlled trial comparing placebo to 2% chlorhexidine versus 2% chlorhexidine or 2% colistin as oral decontamination in patients who had been ventilated for at least 48 hours. And they found that the risk of VAP was decreased by 65% in patients who received chlorhexidine and 55% in those who received chlorhexidine and colistin compared to placebo. And both of these were statistically significant. Subsequently, Patapong and colleagues published in Nature in 2008 another randomized controlled trial. This one, again using 2% chlorhexidine versus saline, but this time done 4 times a day, and found the ventilator-associated pneumonia rates significantly decreased from 7 in the chlorhexidine group to 21 in the saline group, and that was, again, statistically significant. Next was a study by Sona and colleagues, published in 2009. This was a pre-post intervention observational study, cleaning the teeth with sodium monofluorophosphate paste, and then brush, rinse with water, and then an application of 0.12% chlorhexidine twice a day. The results, they found the pre-intervention VAP rate was 5.2 versus the intervention rate of 2.4 per 1,000 ventilator days, and this was statistically significant. So a variety of different approaches using different concentrations and different number of applications of chlorhexidine as oral decontamination. This is a figure from one hospital where they implemented the ventilator-associated pneumonia bundle, and as you can see in red is compliance with that bundle, and as compliance rises from about 50% at the beginning to nearly 100%, the ventilator-associated pneumonia rate significantly decreases to zero. Interventions have been tried in a number of high-risk populations, including trauma intensive care units by Kocaner and colleagues in the Journal of Trauma in 2006. This was a prospective intervention. Now, they started with a very high rate. At that time, NIST 90th percentile rate of 22.3 to 32.7 per ventilator associated per 1,000 ventilator days was very high. But they used a VAP bundle and then audited compliance. This was about a study from November 2002 to June of 2003, and the ventilator associated pneumonia rate stayed between 0 and 12.8 per 1,000 ventilator days, and saved them approximately $50,000 per episode. One of the issues I think that's very important for all of our healthcare-associated infections, not just ventilator-associated pneumonia, but a study's been done on VAP and one actually on central line-associated bloodstream infections that show the need for us to move our education more strongly to nursing personnel. This was a study by LeBeau and colleagues published in Journal of Hospital Infection in 2008 where they did a questionnaire of European intensive care nurses and testing them there on their knowledge of evidence-based guidelines for prevention of VAP. They had 3,329 questionnaires, had a response rate of almost 70%, but the average score was less than 50%. 55% knew that the oral route is a recommended route for intubation. 35% knew that ventilator circuit should be changed with each new patient. 38% knew that heat and moisture exchanges were the recommended humidifier type, but only 21% knew that these should be changed weekly. 46% recommended closed suction system. 18% knew that they should be changed with each new patient, etc. And there's not a whole lot of difference in the result when central line associated bloodstream infection prevention questionnaire was done in a similar population. So we need to recognize that many of us in infection control may know these things, but that doesn't mean that the physician and the nurse at the bedside does, and they're the ones that have to implement it. So prevention of VAP includes standard infection control practices such as hand hygiene, minimizing duration, intensity of sedation and device exposure, position the patient in a semi-recumbent position, appropriate use of enteral feeding antibiotics and selected medical devices, use of sterile water for irrigation, keeping a closed suction system, and mouth care, particularly chlorhexidine mouth or teeth cleaning. What about surgical site infections? Well, most of the focus on surgical site infections has been on a limited number of activities. One is appropriate surgical antimicrobial prophylaxis. A major intervention done in the United States involving the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services was first a national retrospective study and then a prospective application of providing appropriate antibiotic prophylaxis. In this study published by Brathler and colleagues, 3,000 hospitals, a systematic random sample of U.S. hospitals, over 34,000 Medicare patients, focusing on cardiac, vascular, colorectal, knee and hip, and hysterectomy procedures in 2001. Their quality indicators were given the right antibiotic prophylaxis, given at the right time within 1 hour of the procedure, and stopping it correctly. I guess not surprisingly, but certainly disappointingly, they found that although 91% of the time the appropriate guideline antibiotic was used, 65% of the time the antibiotic was given within 1 hour, but only 42% of the time was the antibiotic discontinued within 24 hours. But most importantly, you want all three done correctly, not one or two done correctly. And when they looked at all three, 28% of the time all three were done correctly. So a lot of room for improvement. Let me just mention one point about this, and that is right now, in looking at this, giving antibiotics at the right time, it's within 1 hour. And I've been in several hospitals where they've claimed 95-99% compliance with that, and when you look at the records, you find that many of the patients are receiving their antibiotic prophylaxis 5 minutes, 10 minutes, even 15 minutes before the incision. And this indicator really should be 30 minutes to 1 hour, not 0 to 1 hour. Because obviously giving an antibiotic infusion minutes before you do the incision is not going to be effective. In fact, if you look at the data on cephalosporin prophylaxis and cardiac surgery programs, the median time to peak blood level in mediastinal bone is 22 minutes. So if you're giving the antibiotic 5 minutes before the incision, it's not going to be very effective. Interesting study by Bodie and colleagues out of Holland on preventing surgical site infections in nasal carriers of Staph aureus. This is a randomized controlled trial, multi-center at three different universities and two general hospitals in Holland, done over almost a two-year period of time, and they were assessing whether rapid identification of Staph aureus nasal colonization using PCR, followed by eradication with mupirocin and chlorhexidine, would reduce surgical site infections of Staph aureus. They had almost 7,000 patients screened, 1,270 nasal swabs from 1,251 patients. 18.5% of them were culture positive for Staph. 917 were enrolled in the intention to treat analysis, of which 808 or 88% underwent a surgical procedure. Interestingly, certainly would not be the case in the United States, all of the Staph aureus strains identified by PCR. This is a two-year study. Surgical site infections were susceptible to methicillin. The rate of Staph aureus infection was 3.4% in the mupirocin chlorhexidine group and over twice that, 7.7% in the placebo group. So a statistically significant reduction in Staph aureus surgical site infection rate. When you screen them and decolonize those that have Staph aureus, the effect of this intervention was most pronounced for the deep surgical site infections, the one that costs both our patients and our healthcare systems the most. And the time to onset of these infections was shorter in the placebo group than in the mupirocin chlorhexidine group. And this slide shows the results where you see a significant reduction. Again, deep surgical site infections have the greatest impact. And what's important also is that you see a significant reduction in infections where the source was endogenous, whereas you don't see a significant reduction where it's exogenous. And this is logical. The patient's organism is what you're going after, not those of the healthcare workers or the environment. So SSI prevention bundle would include the correct antimicrobial prophylaxis, given the right drug at the right time and discontinuing correctly, no shaving of hair, use of clippers, adequate perioperative glucose control. A lot of debate now about how close that control should be. Normal thermia during surgery, except for cardiac surgery, and then pre-op screening for Staph aureus or MRSA, and a positive decolonization. What about MRSA control? Well, we have more and more studies coming out showing the efficacy of active detection and isolation. The Dutch, the Danes, etc., have shown this for years. Robicek and colleagues published their study in Annals of Internal Medicine in 2008, where they did an observational prospective intervention study where they did universal screening of all patients admitted using an MRSA PCR. This was done at three hospitals in Evanston, Illinois. And then they compared it with passive surveillance, where they did clinical detection for 12 months, targeted surveillance cultures, that was really high-risk patients or ICU patients, plus clinical cultures for 12 months, and then universal screening of patients for almost 2 years. They did nasal screening using PCR. Those who were MRSA positive had contact isolation, and they did use decolonization with mupirocin. And as you can see on this slide, with the various time periods, they had a 70% reduction in MRSA healthcare-associated infections. Another study done in another hospital focusing on intensive care units in the Illinois area by Parada and colleagues showed almost the same thing, a 67% reduction in MRSA healthcare-associated infections with universal screening. More recently in the United States, we've had the Veterans Hospital Administration have a major MRSA control program, and their bundle includes active surveillance testing using PCR, hand hygiene, contact isolation, and then, quote, cultural transformation. Initially, this was focused on approximately 150 hospitals and their ICUs. Because of success of that, they expanded to all VA hospitals and all patients, universal testing. And then because of the impact of that, they've moved it to their nursing homes as well. You can see they've had over a 50% decrease in MRSA infections in their intensive care unit, 29% decrease in MRSA outside of their intensive care unit, both of which have reached statistical significance. More and more hospitals are reporting their results. And in fact, if you even look at the CDC MMWR report on decrease of central line associated bloodstream infections and you read it very carefully, the gram-negative BSI rate did not decrease. The major decrease was Staph aureus. And I would bet the major decrease was Staph aureus or MRSA, and secondary to more and more hospitals in their ICUs doing active detection and isolation. So our MRSA prevention bundle is to screen either high-risk patients or all patients, preoperative screening, particularly of surgical implant patients, cardiac, neuro, orthopedic surgery, and if they're MRSA positive, to decolonize them with mupirocin, chlorhexidine bathing, plus or minus use of vancomycin prophylaxis. Use of barrier precautions for those that are MRSA positive, colonized, or infected, and hygiene and environmental cleaning. So in conclusion, zero tolerance. That is trying to prevent all preventable healthcare-associated infections is the new horizon for infection control. It's the world we're all living in now. Benchmarking. What is benchmarking? You comparing your rate to mine. Should be avoided. Why would you compare your rate to mine or to a national database? Do you know what they're doing? Do you know what their patients are? For instance, for central line associated bloodstream infections, do you know what type of lines they use? Do you know how many lumens they have? Do you know if they have an IV team? Do you know what needleless connector they're using? Do you know if they draw blood through that needleless connector? Do they use stopcocks? Do they have a closed system? You don't know any of those things. So why would you be comparing your rate to them? You should compare your rate to your own rate, and your goal should be zero. Most healthcare-associated infection prevention interventions are low technology and are not expensive. Virtually every one of these interventions that I've talked about, cost-efficacy studies have been done, and the cost of implementing them is significantly less than the cost of treating the infection. Implementation of evidence-based prevention interventions, including bundles with the latest technology, should be a high priority for all infection control personnel. We should be striving to achieve a zero rate of preventable healthcare-associated infection. We should have the passion to achieve that. I know it's not easy. We're often dealing with hospital administrators where the most important thing is cost, or with product committees where, again, the most important thing is cost. But we in infection control should be the advocate for our patients. We know how to prevent many of these healthcare-associated infections, and we should be the driving force to make sure that that happens. Thank you very much.
Dr. Jarvis, thank you for that extremely comprehensive and very passionate advocacy on behalf of our patients. I think many of the points you made are well made. Particularly, I was struck with the fact that a bundle should be a minimum and not a maximum set of precautions. I think sometimes people fall into the, if I have done the checklist, that's all I need to do. And I don't think that is necessarily the case. And the second point that you brought out right in your concluding slide is comparing your own rate to your own rate is really important, and not trying to compare with other organizations, because, as you so rightly said, you have no idea what other organizations are doing and what they're doing to drive down their infection rates, or if they're doing anything. And certainly in the UK, where national league tables, if you like, of infection are being published and people are looking at other organizations, trying to make comparisons is very, very difficult and very confusing for patients when they're trying to choose where to get their health care. So those points were very well made. I'd like to thank everybody for listening to today's Weber Training teleclass. I hope you've enjoyed it as much as I have, and I hope you enjoy the rest of your day. Thank you very much for joining us. Goodbye.